Blog Talk Radio.
Back in 1927, an American socialist, Norman Thomas, six times candidate for president on the Socialist Party ticket, said the American people would never vote for socialism. But he said under the name of liberalism, the American people will adopt every fragment of the socialist program. There are many ways in which our government has invaded the precincts of private citizens, the method of earning a living. Our government is in business to the extent of owning more than 19,000 businesses covering 47 different lines of activity. This amounts to a fifth of the total industrial capacity of the United States. But at the moment, I'd like to talk about another way, because this threat is with us and at the moment is more imminent. One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. It's very easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project. Most people are a little reluctant to oppose anything that suggests medical care for people who possibly can't afford it. Now, the American people, if you put it to them about socialized medicine and gave them a chance to choose, would unhesitatingly vote against it. We had an example of this under the Truman administration. It was proposed that we have a compulsory health insurance program for all people in the United States, and of course, the American people unhesitatingly rejected this. So, with the American people on record as not wanting socialized medicine, Congressman Farrand introduced the Farrand Bill. This was the idea that all people of Social Security age should be brought under a program of compulsory health insurance. Now, this would not only be our senior citizens, this would be the dependents and those who are disabled. This would be young people if they are dependents of someone eligible for Social Security. Now, Congressman Farrand brought the program out on that idea of just for that particular group of people. But Congressman Farrand was subscribing to this foot-in-the-door philosophy because he said, if we can only break through and get our foot inside the door, then we can expand the program after that.
Living and dying with the choices I've made.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Women Patriots. We broadcast every Tuesday night here on Conservative Nation Radio. Tonight, I want to go back a little bit and take us back to the time of Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers. Many great thoughts came from Mr. Jefferson and President Jefferson, but I'm going to start tonight. I want to read just from his first inaugural address, because it will emphasize, I think, the extent to which our current administration has overstepped the bounds of what our founding fathers actually met for the office to represent. And so we're going to start out, I'm just going to read, this was on March 4th of 1801. It was his first inaugural address in Washington. It had been a close battle for the presidency. Him and Aaron Burr had both received 73 electoral votes. And so they had to have the special session. And after 30 hours of debate and balloting, Thomas Jefferson emerged as the president with Mr. Burr as his vice president. So I'm just going to read. Here we go. Friends and fellow citizens, called upon to undertake the duties of the first executive office of our country, I avail myself of the presence of that portion of my fellow citizens, which is here assembled, to express my grateful thanks for the favor which they have pleased to look toward me. So he viewed this as a favor to be elected president. He took it humbly. It was a favor from the people to declare a sincere consciousness that the task is above my talents and that I approach it with this anxious and awful presentiment, which the greatness of the charge and the weakness of my power so justly inspire. What an attitude coming from a man who had just been elected president of the newly free, well, now he was the third president of our country, but this is a man also that actually wrote the Declaration of Independence, which we will go into a little bit later in our show, because there's some very interesting things that he actually wrote when he first presented it that were vetoed out by the southern states. But he approaches this with such humility to this office. A rising nation spread over a wide and fruitful land, transversing all the seas with the rich productions of their industry, engaged in commerce with nations who feel power and forget right. Feel power and forget right. Advancing rapidly to destinies beyond the reach of mortal eye. When I contemplate these transcendent objects and see the honor, the happiness, and the hopes of this beloved country committed to the issue and the auspices of this day, I shrink from the contemplation and humble myself before the magnitude of the undertaking. Humility, something that is greatly missing in Washington today with our current, not only president, but I believe also with the leaders in the Democratic, Senator Reid, Congressman Pelosi, and even the Republican side. We have this humility is not there. It's like it's owed to them to do what they do in Washington, what is in our best, what they think is in our best interest. And I'm going back to the letter. Utterly, indeed, should I despair, did not the presence of many who I here see remind me that in the other high authorities provided by our Constitution, I shall find resources of wisdom, of virtue, and of zeal on which to rely under all difficulties. To you, then, gentlemen, who are charged with the sovereign functions of legislation, and to those associated with you, I look with encouragement for that guidance and support which may enable us to steer with the safety the vessel in which we are all embarked amidst the complex, conflicting elements of a troubled world. Now, that's a lot to say, that he was going to look forward with encouragement and guidance to Congress, because Congress has the right to legislate. What we are seeing with President Obama, with him throwing money here and there and making all these declarations, this is not constitutional. You won't find it in the Constitution, and you certainly don't find it in one of the founding fathers who had a very heavy hand in the writing of the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence and the fight for the freedom of this country. And that's what he just said in that in his first inaugural address, is that he looked forward to the guidance from Congress. And we don't see that today. During the contest of opinion through which we have passed, the animation of discussions and of exertions has sometimes worn an aspect which might impose on strangers unused to think freely and to speak and to write what they think. So in other words, this whole thing was not without conflict, and that other people might have viewed the animated conversations strangely. But that was part of being this free country, where everybody had the right to express their opinion. But this being now decided by the voice of the nation, announced according to the rules of the Constitution, all will, of course, arrange themselves under the will of law and unite in common efforts for the common good. Okay, so they didn't agree on everything here, but we have this Constitution that was written and is the law of our land. And of course, he just assumed outrightly, because he knows that they will arrange themselves under the will of the law and that they will unite for the common good. All too will bear in mind this sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable. Okay, and here we go. The will of the majority is in all cases to prevail. Did we see that in California when they voted against the marriage proposals? No, we didn't see that. Was it reasonable to maintain that marriage should be between a man and a woman, as it has been for the last thousands and thousands and thousands of years? Well, yes. That the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. And let us reflect that having banished from our land that religious intolerance under which mankind so long bled and suffered. Okay, and he is talking about, in reference to the Catholic Church, which ruled and from as the king and as the power of the land, and did things that were not really scriptural, and made all people follow that religion and not the religion of their choice, or the Church of England, even where the queen or king was the head of the Church of England, and you were put in prison if you actually practiced any other religion. So they had a religious intolerance. And we have to keep this in mind when we look at the Declaration of Independence, and when we look at the First Amendment, which guarantees us the right of freedom of religion. And this was because of the persecutions. Thomas Jefferson had seen this because he was well-traveled. He had traveled to France and spent time in France and England, and he was well-knowledgeable about the intolerance of the religion of that time. And this also kind of turned him off in his lifetime from the institutions of religion, and so he did not actually associate with one certain religion. Okay, and let me continue. And I've lost my place because I kind of got really involved in all that. Okay, so we will find it. Let's see. During the throes and convulsions of the ancient world, during the agonizing spasms of an infuriated man seeking through blood and slaughter his long-lost liberty, it was not wonderful that the agitation of the billows should reach even this distant and peaceful shore, that this should be more felt and feared by some and less by others, and should divide opinions as to measure of safety. But every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. So we can have different opinions, but not actually differing in principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We were all Republicans. We are all Federalists. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union, the United States of America, or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated. So we tolerate differences and errors of opinion where reason is left free to combat it. In other words, you have to have reason free to combat. I know indeed that some honest men fear that a Republican government cannot be strong, that this government is not strong enough. But would the honest patriot, in the full tide of successful experiment, abandon a government which has so far kept us free and firm on the theoretic and visionary fear that this government, the world's best hope, may by possibility want energy to preserve itself? I trust not. I believe this, on the contrary, the strongest government on earth. I believe it is the only one where every man, at the call of the law, would fly to the standard of the law and would meet invasions of the public order as his own personal concern. Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? Or have we found angels in the form of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question. So he believed that our great nation, that men would fight for it, and up until this day we have. And for the first time, when they asked the question, you know, would you rather have liberty or security? It was a 50-50 tie between security and liberty, instead of liberty winning the way. We're going very, very wrong in this country. Let us then, with courage and confidence, pursue our own federal and Republican principles, our attachment to union and representative government, kindly separated by nature in a wide ocean from the exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe, too high-minded to endure the degradations of the others, possessing a chosen country with room enough for our descendants to the thousands and thousands of generations, entertaining a due sense of our equal right to the use of our own faculties, to the acquisitions of our own industry, to honor and confidence from our fellow citizens, resulting not from birth, but from our actions and their sense of them, enlightened by a benign religion, professed indeed and practiced in various forms. Again, the freedom of religion and being practiced in various forms, yet all of them inculcating honesty, truth, temperance, gratitude, and the love of man, acknowledging and adoring an overruling providence, which by all its dispensations prove that it delights in the happiness of man here and his greater happiness hereafter with all these blessings. A reference to the hereafter, a reference to the good things about religion, the honesty, the truth, the patience, and gratitude that all Christians should have. With all these blessings, what more is necessary to make us a happy and prosperous people? Still one more thing, fellow citizens. A wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and that shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government, and this is necessary to close the circles of our felicities. Wow. That one little paragraph there from Thomas Jefferson. And look at our government today. Is it frugal? Is it leaving men free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement? Is it taking from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned? Wow. You know, obviously we've got some major, major problems in the government. About to enter, fellow citizens, on the exercise of duties which comprehend everything dear in value to you, it is proper you should understand what I deem the essential principles of our government and consequently those which ought to shape it. Administration, I will compress them within the narrowest compass they will bear, stating the general principle but not all its limitations. Equal and exact justice to all men of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political, peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. The support of the state government, here's a good one, the support of the state governments in all their rights as the most competent administrations for our domestic concerns. The state government as the most competent administration for our domestic concerns and the surest bulwarks against anti-Republican tendencies. The preservation of the general government in its whole constitutional vigor as the sheet anchor of our peace at home and safety abroad, a jealous care of the right of the election by the people, a mild and safe corrective of abuses which are lopped by the sword of revolution where peaceful remedies are unprovided, absolute acquiescence in the decisions of the majority, the vital principles of republics from which is no appeal but to force, the vital principle and immediate parent of despotism. A well-disciplined militia, our best reliance in peace and for the first moments of war, till regulars may relieve them. The supremacy of the civil over the military authority. Economy and the public expense, that labor might be lightly burthened. And I believe that's burdened, but they burthened. B-U-R-T-H-E-N-E-D is the word that they use in the day. The honest payment of our debts. Okay, honest payment of our debts. Look at our $15 trillion debt that we have today, which is just, you know, crazy, just insane. And sacred preservation of the public faith. Encouragement of agriculture and of commerce as its handmaid, the diffusion of information and arrangement of all abuses at the bar of the public reason, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of person under the protection of the habeas corpus, and trial by juries, impartially selected. These principles form the bright constellation which has gone before us and guided our steps through an age of revolution and reform. Now, this is interesting because trial by juries, impartially selected. We have the recent cases of people being tried by the press. This is just outrageous in this country and in which we live. The wisdom of our sages and blood of our heroes have been devoted to their attainment. They should be the creed of our political faith, the text of civics instruction, the touchstone by which to try the services of those we trust. And should we wander from them in moments of error or alarm, let us hasten to retrace our steps to regain the road, which alone leads to peace, liberty, and safety. We have not been vigilant, my fellow Americans. We have wandered very, very far from the concept of this country, and we have not hastened to retrace our steps. And we have a big and heavy road. ahead of us in that aspect. I repair then, fellow citizens, to the post you have assigned me, with experience enough in subordinate offices to have seen the difficulties of this, the greatest of all. I have learned to expect that it will rarely fall to the lot of imperfect men to retire from the station with the reputation and the favor which bring it unto him, without pretensions to that high confidence you repose in our first and greatest revolutionary character, whose preeminent services have entitled him the first place in his country's love and destined him the fairest page in the volume of faithful history. I ask so much confidence only as may give firmness and effect to the legal administration of your affairs. I shall often go wrong through defective judgment. When right, I shall often be thought wrong by those whose positions will not command a view of the whole ground. I ask your indulgence for my own errors, which will never be intentional, and your support against the errors of others, who may condemn what they would not if seen in all of its parts. The approbation implied by your suffrage is a great consolation to me for the past, and my future solitude will be to retain the good opinion of those who have bestowed it in advance, to conciliate that of others by doing them all good in my power, and to be instrumental to the happiness and freedom of all. Relying then on the patronage of your goodwill, I advance with obedience to the work, ready to retire from it whenever you become sensible how much better it is in your power to make. And may the infinite power which rules the destinies of the universe lead our counsels to what is best, and give them a favorable issue for your peace and prosperity. So this is Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address, and in it we see many issues being addressed that today are just out of control. And we also, I want to bring attention to that last verse, and may that infinite power which rules the destinies of the universe, okay, that is God, lead our counsels to what is best and give them a favorable issue for your peace and prosperity. Now, I know I had a caller and they dropped, and I encourage them to call back in. I was just doing my introduction, which was actually the first inaugural address from Thomas Jefferson. Our call-in number is 718-305-7176. Billy's not with me yet tonight because I think she probably tuned in earlier, and of course I screwed up the schedule again trying to get this scheduled for 9 p.m. Eastern time. But here's the points in this first inaugural address from Thomas Jefferson, who actually was part, he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and he is felt to be the mind behind the writing of the Constitution itself. Number one, that we have the freedom of religion, that we don't have religious intolerance. And yet, what do we see today? The mockery of Kirk Cameron because of his belief in God and his belief in the Bible. You know, we don't have open discussion about that, as Rick Santorum would have said, in the square. Instead, we are to be ridiculed. Ridiculed for what? For believing in our God and our religion? Now, Thomas Jefferson, like I said, he was not practicing in any of the religions. He felt that some of the greatest evil was done in the name of religion, which is absolutely true. If you look at the history, you know, the Catholic Church and the Church of England, what they did in England and France. And if you read, he also had his own, he was translating the life of Jesus because he thought Jesus was the most moral person to ever live. And here's my caller, so I'm going to take that call real quick. Hi, this is Brenda. Who do I have at 410?
Hi, this is Corey Andrews. I called in last week.
Oh, hi, Corey. How are you?
Good. I'm just going to make it quick. I just wanted to comment that I've enjoyed the show so far. The show so far tonight, and keep it up. It's a really good show.
Okay. Well, thank you. You have any questions or anything to add to that? I just find this really fascinating as I'm reading Thomas Jefferson's own letters and his autobiography, and just, you know, getting some insight into the man. And I think we all need to do that because I think it gives us insight into the actual Constitution and to what they actually meant for this country to be. I think if you take that away, you lose a big impact of you know, what the Constitution is actually telling us.
Yep.
So, so that's why I kind of wanted to go into that, you know, tonight and just kind of review, and we'll do other founding fathers also. You know, Thomas Jefferson just kind of comes to mind as he was so prevalent in the writings. Very intelligent man, scientifically minded. Archaeology was one of his things that he liked to do, and just such a knowledgeable man. So, but yes, I appreciate your listening.
I enjoy it.
Feel free to, you know, ask any questions. I know we had quite the discussion last week, and I will probably get back to one of those topics tonight a little bit later on. We were talking about, we kind of got cut off on the drug usage thing last week, and so I was doing a little bit of research on that, and so I hope
you get into that. Yeah, huh? If you get back to that tonight, I'll call back in.
That'll be great. Thanks, Corey.
Yep. Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay. Anybody out there wants to call and just talk or voice their opinions, you're welcome to call in 718-305-7176. I'm just right now commenting on Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address. And we were just talking about how he, with the religion, and that religious intolerance was a problem. And we're seeing that again today, only from a different aspect. But also, you know, when I started in his speech, the humility with which he came to the presidency, how humbled he was, and how he revered the Congress, who was to be the legislators, and to have, for them to look with encouragement and guidance, and how he, the support that he was going to get from them. And what do we see today? We see a president out here just running amok, just doing, and Congress is doing nothing to stop him. We have no separation of the powers. It looks like the Supreme Court is going to come to our rescue. Fortunately, we currently at this time have, you know, five judges who seem to be constitutionally minded, who are hopefully going to save us from some of this out of control power grab that is going on, you know, in regards to health care and in regards to illegal immigration and suing the states. Can you believe that? Suing the states here in his inaugural speech, he talks about the power of the states and how we have to maintain the power to those states because they knew best how to rule themselves. And yet, are we seeing that today? No. What we see going on today in Washington is this huge power grab. You know, they want to, the EPA, the regulations, telling the states what they can and cannot do, taking all the money and concentrating it. Well, we all know what happens when you concentrate money. It's corruption. You know, it's greed. It's a loss of values. So what we have to do is we have to get that money out of that concentrated place where it never belonged in the first place. You know, we were looking at the founding father here, Thomas Jefferson, who's saying the states have the right to govern themselves and for the use of the monies, not Washington, D.C. And that's another lesson. We can learn this all just from his inaugural speech, not to mention if you go into his papers farther, which I intend to do because I'm learning so much from this man and getting into his mind. And I do want to go to the part of the Declaration of Independence that was left out simply to appease what was then Virginia and South Carolina, because Thomas Jefferson really, I think, was ahead of his time. He was a man of science, as I discussed with Corey, archaeology, and just really in his thinking ahead of his time. Also, you know, we talked, I can't say this enough about how he believed this was a great country. And today we have people living here that don't believe this is a great country. We have the new Black Panther Party who was on television saying that they're not part of American. They're not American because the Constitution didn't apply to them. That makes me sad. And how can anybody, you know, live in this country and feel that way? But it's interesting because I did go to a Tea Party. I don't consider myself Tea Party. I consider myself more of a right-wing Republican, social, fiscal conservative. But we have such similar views, the Tea Party. I think it's kind of almost a blend of the right-wing Republicans, just not so much on the religious aspect. But there was a guy there, and he was a Hispanic, and he grew up in the hood, and he knows of the indoctrination that goes on, an indoctrination that Herman Cain first introduced us to, at least if you listen to his speeches. And he talked of the indoctrination that goes on in the poor communities about how bad the man is, the white man, and how racist we, the Republicans and the Tea Party, are. And it's an indoctrination. And it was, he had been in prison for 3 years, but he had finally listened to the message. And now his name is political, and he raps, because that's how you reach our young people. And he raps about our country and our freedom and our liberty and how great this country is, and what we, a lot of people who live here in America, don't even know how great our country is, because they take it for granted. And that is a bad thing. We can never take for granted the greatness of this country, because once we do, we go down that path. And we've started down that path, and I see more and more people waking up, and that's a good thing. But we must fight. We must fight now. We can't just say, well, nobody's going to listen to me because I didn't get my way in the primaries. That's not good enough. That wouldn't be good enough for Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Benjamin Franklin or these men who literally faced Great Britain, one of the armies of the time, and fought for the independence of this country, this sovereignty, this great United States of America. In his speech, "A wise and frugal government." Okay. Is anybody going to call in tonight and tell me that we have a wise and frugal government? Because if you are, I think you need to go and take a little bit closer look at what's actually going on in the government today, and how the spending is out of control, and how much waste there is in government. And I can tell you, there aren't enough millionaires in this country to pay off the debt by taxing them more. And I can guarantee you, there's not a millionaire in this country that wouldn't pay more taxes if you get rid of the corruption, and you get rid of the greed, and you get rid of the unnecessary departments and the unnecessary control that Washington is trying to influence our states with. Because this great United States, it's called the United States for a reason. The states have the power that was not granted in the Constitution. And in the original Constitution, the government had the power to negotiate with foreign countries, obviously, because you need to do that as a bloc. You can't do that. We can't have 50 states running around and trying to interact with various foreign governments. It doesn't work, okay? That doesn't work. It wouldn't work. That was one of their powers. And to provide us with safety and security, secure our borders, that we might not be attacked from without. Now, and originally, you know, these are only 13 states to begin with, and they were added along the way. But even with those 13 states as a block, they had the power and they had the cohesiveness to unite. And they didn't agree on everything. Some didn't believe in slavery. Some did. Not everybody agreed with Thomas Jefferson. There were some that wanted him to, you know, proclaim his religion loudly from the church tops, which he refused to do because he looked at Jesus as an example. And Jesus said, you know, pray in the closet. And I'm not saying you should pray in the closet, but this is an insight into Thomas Jefferson. And this is a man, he thought Jesus was one of the most moral men to ever walk the earth. And he thought that we could all be better by following him and his moral values. And I have quotes that I can back that up with from Thomas Jefferson himself. He didn't believe in Jesus as part of the Trinity. I'm not going to agree with him there, because I believe there is three in one. And there may be others. There's others out there that don't believe that. But he did believe in the morality, that there was never a more moral man, and that we needed to base our lives on how Jesus lived his life. And that's where the Jefferson Bible comes in. It's just about the life of Jesus. Okay. And also, from what we can take from this context of his first inaugural speech back in the 1800s, the preservation of the general government in its whole constitutional vigor as the sheet anchor of our peace at home and safety abroad. Okay. Peace at home, safety abroad. That's what the government's supposed to do. A jealous care of the right of election by the people. Unfortunately, today, we're seeing it's a lot more about money and not so much about the people voting through the years and the multiple changes in the laws and the way that we nominate and the two-party system. Two-party system is bad, and I think it may have been Thomas Jefferson that said that. I would have to go back and review, which I downloaded 2,000 papers on Thomas Jefferson, so I know at one point I'm pretty sure it is Thomas Jefferson that said that a two-party system isn't good. And the reason it isn't good is because you get the polarizing effect that we see today of the far left and the far right, and you're not about the good of the country anymore. It's all about your issues and your incentives. But you know what? You know how to stop that? Send it back to the states. Send it back to the individual states. If you don't like what's going on in your state, you can move to a different state. Get it out of the federal government. Doesn't belong there, never belonged there. This is a process of infiltration. Read the list. I refer the list often. 1963 communist agenda to turn America off its path. Now, you're trying to say, oh, well, communism is not such a big thing anymore. Doesn't change the fact that they're trying to destroy America through these agendas. And when they do, all free countries will suffer. Not just America. Not just us. We are the beacon of the free world. We are and can. We can be, again, that city on the shining hill that other countries can say, oh, we want to be like them. We want to be free like them. We want to be like America. And I'd like to see that happen again in our country. And I pray to God that it will happen. We're in a very troubled time right now with our own leaders in this country. Many of them openly members of the Communist Party. The Communist Party sued in September 2010 the Democratic Party for stealing their platform. And where's the news media in all of this? Okay, where is the news media? They're not there because they are part of the problem. They are actually part of the problem. And then I want to finish this last, I want to go back to this last paragraph about that he was talking about. Let me find it real quick because I'm reading this from the paper itself and I didn't actually put my notes down, so you'll have to bear with me. About this part, you know, this part is interesting about how when he's wrong, you know, he wants to be told and he's going to try to be right, but you know there's going to always be somebody who thinks they're wrong, and we have that going on today. That happens always when you've got decisions that you make with information that not everybody has. I take the George Zimmerman case when it was first brought out and it was tried on TV with only partial information, and it just polarized to opposite effects, people usually by race, unfortunately. And yet, as we see the facts coming out, it is not at all. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy, but it may appear not to be at all what was first thought when it was reported in the media. But just the overall humbleness, his willingness to work for the people, his willingness to keep the government small and justice for all men, but the majority should rule when it was not harmful to the minority. And so that was his first inaugural speech. Now, I won't go into it tonight because it's a long speech, and obviously the second inaugural speech gets even better. So we might save that for next week. Again, if you want to join the discussion, you're free to call in at 718-305-7176. But since I brought up the race issue, I do want to read. Because as I told you, Thomas Jefferson was actually called upon to write the Declaration of Independence back in 1776. And part of what he put in there, when he sent the letter to what he wanted when before they sent the letter to England. This is actually deleted from his original piece. You know, let me start at the beginning so we can actually, you know, have the beginning part of this for any of those who don't know what it says. I'm assuming that most people who are listening here tonight do have a clue as to what it says. That when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, America with England, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, equal station, equal, given by God, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. So he wants to let them know why. Why do we want this separation from England? Okay, basically, they were being taxed, they were being deported, they were being tried over in England, and yet England was waging war in America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with inherent and certain inalienable rights. Now, they took out the inherent and it put in certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So they get their powers from who? From the people. Government doesn't own us. The government doesn't have the power. We, the people, have the power. That was given to us by our founding fathers. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, I wanted to go back there because it says that all men are created equal. And I know that Herman Cain would say this, and he said all men are created equal, and they would call him on this because they would say, well, the black man wasn't included in that. But I'm going back to the very original draft that Thomas Jefferson drafted to bring before what they called the Congress of the time, the Continental Congress. It comes after the part where it talks about the Indians, and then it goes, he, talking about the king, has incited treasonable insurrections of our fellow citizens with the allurements of forfeiture and confiscation of our property. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportations thither. Some of these words are tongue twisters for me. Sorry, you'll have to just bear with me. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep an open market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished die. He is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them by murdering the people on whom he has also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. So, when anybody tries to tell you that all men were created equal under our Declaration of Independence, that Thomas Jefferson was not including the black man, they are wrong, because he did. What happened, and it goes on in this book that I've actually been reading, was that they wanted to have a cohesiveness, because you can imagine at the time, you know, they're talking about going up against Great Britain. Okay, Great Britain was the military might of that day. They were the ruling nation among countries. And so they wanted a cohesiveness among the 13 colonies if they could get them. And it took them a while. This didn't happen overnight. They had these resolutions. They wanted to send this letter. And at first, you know, New York and Delaware and some of those countries were against it because the people weren't ready for it. And so, you know, they had to keep holding out, and they had to keep holding their conversation. But here, this portion was actually had to be stricken from the Declaration of Independence, not because Thomas Jefferson didn't believe that all men were free and that slavery was cruel and it was a crime against mankind, but because in South Carolina and Georgia, to keep them in the Union, because at the time they had the plantations where they used the slaves to for their commerce, in order to get them to agree to send this letter and sign on to this letter and fight for the independence of our nation, they had to strike that portion. I wonder, you know, I have to sit here and wonder if, you know, looking, you know, hindsight is often much easier than foresight, you know, and if he had known, if Thomas Jefferson had known about the Civil War that was to come and claim lives of all Americans, both North and South, if there would have been more of a battle on that portion of the Declaration of Independence at that time. But it's interesting also that as I read through this and I see that they have the same arguments that we have today with our illegal immigrants. Oh, the cost of the product will go up if you do away with our slaves because it's going to cost us more to produce them. Well, what did they tell us about immigration today? Oh, well, nobody in America, and the cost of our product is going to go up because nobody's going to do this work for the price that they do. And it's just really fascinating that here, you know, over 200 years later, you know, you can look at this man and see the same arguments going on today in a different aspect but the same arguments that were going on at that point in time. Thomas Jefferson actually was considered a liberal in his day and time. So I don't think we would call him that today. In fact, I'm pretty sure that it's the Republicans. We're not the Ku Klux Klan, nor are we the ones trying to stir up the racial tensions in this world today. Despite beliefs to the contrary and indoctrination to the contrary that's going on among our people. So, but I found that very fascinating as I was reading through his original version of the Declaration of Independence. And it was also in, I believe, he brought it before the Virginia legislature, also trying to get slavery outlawed through that aspect, which also did not really go through for him. But so Thomas Jefferson did not believe in enslaving any human beings. He believed in the value and the worth of all human life. And when he says that man was created equal, he meant men. Now, women, we are a different story. But historically, you know, women were to be seen, not heard. Mothers are wonderful things. And I would never degrade a mother because the value of the mother on raising the children and caring for the children, you could not compensate a woman enough money for doing that. But even as we see in the Constitution, the black man got voting rights before women did through women's suffrage. And so that's kind of been like the history through time. But now we're onto this women's subject, and I really wish Billy were here because Billy can talk so much more to this too. I think I entered the wrong time and had the show starting at 11 Eastern, and she probably peeked and thought, oh, we're not going on till 11. So, and then I went to find a phone, and of course, when I need a phone, we have like four phones in the house. I couldn't find a phone to call her. So here, you're just going to have to listen to me ramble on. But we go so much beyond today, because women today have every right to do everything that a man does today. That's equality. Going above and beyond that is not equality. Making special consolations for a woman is not equality. You want to be in the army? Fine. But you need to keep up and do exactly what that man will do. I'm a woman, folks, okay? So don't tell me I'm waging a war on women. I'm a grandmother, a mother, a registered nurse. I work. I've been there, done that. Been a single mother. I know how it goes. I live in this world. But I'm sorry. It's not equality when they make concessions so that you can be a part of a group. If you can't keep up with what is expected, they should not lower expectations so that you can be a part of it. You need to either raise your expectation or you're not a part of it. And that is not war on women. That is not sexual harassment. That is just plain common sense. Common sense tells us that you either are equal in your education, in your abilities, or you're not. You shouldn't get the job just because you're a woman, because that's not equality. And yet we see with affirmative action that many times there were quotas and the best qualified for the job didn't get it because they had to have so many women or they had to have so many minorities in order to meet their quota. Herman Cain is a wonderful example. And for any of you who have not met the man or listened to the man, you need to go look at him and look at his background. He came from Atlanta, Georgia in the 60s. His parents worked three jobs. He never took anything for granted. He never used his skin color as an excuse for not making it in this world. Nor did he ever accuse people of treating him differently because of the color of his skin. Did he question them? Yes. Outright, went up to his boss, wanted to know why this other guy was always getting the promotions before him. He told him, because he has a master's degree and you don't. So what did Herman Cain do? Did he say, oh, it's just because I'm black? No, he went to school and he got his master's degree because that's equality. And the equality is in the fact that he was able to go get that degree from the same college that an Asian, a white, a woman, any man or woman can go and get that equality from. From there, we move to this. I want to address this war on women because this is this president that we have. You know, in the inaugural speech, Thomas Jefferson was talking about the unity of this country, the unity and being united. And this applies even today. You know, yes, we women didn't have the same rights back then. I don't care. Okay, that was 200 years ago. That was the culture. That's the way it was. Okay, but today we do. But that's not enough. That's not enough. You know, we want to say in the name of choice that we can kill innocent children in the womb because that's our choice. Well, no, I'm here to tell you, ladies, that is not your choice. Your choice is birth control. It's available every corner, market you go to, okay? And if you're not using condoms, you're endangering your health. That is a health concern. A pregnancy is not a disease. It's not a health concern. It's a child. But having unprotected sex is a health concern because not only are there sexually transmitted diseases, gonorrhea, syphilis on the rise again. Oh, come on, people. Really? Really? Have some self-restraint. There's birth control pills. There's sponges. There's multiple ways you can prevent that pregnancy. If you fail to prevent that pregnancy, you no longer have a choice because there is another being involved, and we do not have the right. All beings have the right to life, and that little person inside of you is not a piece of tissue. It's not a piece. It has hands. It has fingers. It has a heartbeat. It is a separate entity from yourself. So if you want to talk women's health, we can talk women's health. And I've talked about this on my show before, the human papillary virus on the rise. It's a sexually transmitted disease. It is harmful. It causes cancer. It kills women. But because of the promiscuity of the feminism movement and of our country today and our lack of morals and our lack of values that actually, and I'm gonna read a quote from Thomas Jefferson. This is one I wrote down, and I don't have the letter. It was actually from I had borrowed a book from a friend, and I wrote this down and didn't have time to find it in my 2,000 pages that I'm working on reading. Reading and reflection and time had convinced me, this is Thomas Jefferson, that the interests of society require the observation of those moral precepts, only in which all religions agree. For all forbid us to murder, steal, plunder, or bear false witness. And I'm going to add, you know, sexual freedom, as most religions would tell you, is not from the Bible. In fact, you know, fornication and adultery are both sins, according to the Bible. And that we should not intermeddle with the particular dogmas in which all religions differ, and which are totally unconnected with morality. So what Thomas Jefferson is saying here is that our society requires that we have this moral fiber that all the religions can agree on. I don't care whether you're Catholic or Protestant, Baptist, whatever you are. Murder is a crime. Now, we do see one religion or perversion of a religion that, unfortunately, murder is acceptable to. And for that, we as a nation must stand up against, because as our founding fathers have said, you know, the moral values of Christianity, that murder, stealing, plundering, taking what isn't yours, or bearing false witness. Bearing false witness is actually telling a lie. You go in and say, somebody did this, and, you know, it's not true. And it's also interesting because Thomas Jefferson also, in some of his writing, talks about the press and how they don't print the truth. Even back in the 1800s, they were misinforming people. In fact, when he wrote his letter to the Banbury Baptists, he was just thrilled to be able to answer them about the separation of church and state, because there were so many people saying he didn't believe in God and he wasn't a Christian. And yet Thomas Jefferson himself felt that he was a Christian in his actions and his beliefs. And he took the time, how many of you have taken the time? He took the time, even when he was president and after he was president. And the Jefferson Bible was never intended for publication. It was for his own, it was released by his family after his death, okay? And so he took the time to meticulously go through and document a chronological lifetime of Jesus and the things that Jesus did and Jesus's morality, because he was inspired by that to live his life in accord with that and felt that all of us would benefit from living our lives in that manner. I'm going to go ahead and play a song at this point, just to take us into the next hour. If you have any questions, any comments you want to add, feel free to call in at 718-305-7176. And I'm just going to make us a little bit of music here. This is one of my favorites from Ella Jackson called The Little Man.
A while back, I just needed to get away. And I got in my car one day and just started heading south. I didn't know where I was going. I just stopped and picked up an atlas so I wouldn't get lost. But I didn't go back to my hometown, but I went in that direction and through a lot of old areas that I'd traveled through, I guess in search of something, in search of a simpler time in my life or whatever. But I went through a lot of small towns that reminded me of where I was raised and places I'd come from. And it was sad because I realized how much they'd changed since I'd been back in those areas. And a lot of places were sad because a lot of them seemed dried up. You know, it was like a lot of the small town businesses and the mom and pop stores and the independence of some of the people who had actually built those towns because of that. They were having trouble staying alive, staying in business because of all the big chains coming in, everything that takes over these days. And I think it's a very colorful and important part of American history, and I hate to see it going away, and I hope it doesn't. And I just wanted to write this song about it, and we made this video in an attempt to recapture some of those scenes and feelings that inspired the song about the little man.
I remember walking round the court square sidewalks, looking in windows, things I couldn't want. There's Johnson's Hardware and Morgan's Jewelry and the old Lee King's Apothecary. They were the little man, the little man. I go back now, the stores are empty, except an old Coke sign dated 1950. Poured it up like they never existed, or renovated and called historic distance. There goes the little man, there goes the little man. Now the court square's just a set of streets that people go around, but they seldom think about the little man. Pump your gas and he'd clean your glass. One cold rainy night he fixed your flat. A new store came where you do it yourself. You buy a lotto ticket and food off the shelf. Forget the little man, forget about that little man. He hung on there for a few more years. He couldn't sell Slurpees, he wouldn't sell beer. Now the bank rents a station to a man down the road, and they sell Velvet Elvis secondhand clothes. There goes the little man, there goes another little man. Now the court square's just a set of streets that people go around, but they seldom think about the little man. Concrete strip, you can buy the whole world in just one trip. You save a penny cause it's jumbo size, and they don't even realize they're killing the little man. All the little man. Now the court square's just a set of streets that people go around, but they seldom think about the little man that built this town before the big money shut him down and killed the little man. Oh, the little man. It wasn't long ago when I was a child, an old black man came, his mule and his plow. He broke the ground where we grew our garden, back before all forgotten. dress of the little man.
Okay, and that's Alan Jackson and the Little Man talking about the businesses going out of the town, and we're losing our little towns, which is the, you know, the center of America. Love that song, love that video. And now I'm going to go into a segment. At the end of our show last week, we had Corey and Joe call in, and we were asked about our opinions on legalizing marijuana here in the United States. And, you know, my view as a mother, grandmother, you know, is no, we don't need any more, you know, temptations for our children. And I say that, yes, it's a temptation because they're illegal, but if it's illegal, I can approach it from that aspect and use that to teach my children not to do that. We also have in my family, unfortunately, a history of addiction to alcohol and other drugs on both sides of the family. And so my children particularly are going to be susceptible to becoming addicted to drugs and alcohol and lead to problems in their lives. But I'm going to address this a little bit from Thomas Jefferson's, a little bit from his view. He wrote a letter in 1822 to Benjamin Waterhouse in response. He said, "Dear sir, I received and read with thankfulness and pleasure your denunciation of the abuses of tobacco and wine. Yet, however sound in its principles, I expect it will be but a sermon to the wind. You will find it as difficult to inculcate these sanative precepts on the sensualities of the present day as to convince an Athanasian that there is but one God. I wish success to both attempts, and am happy to learn from you that the latter, at least, is making progress, and the more rapidly in proportion as our Platonizing Christians make more stir and noise about it. The doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man, that there is only one God and he is all perfect, that there is a future state of reward and punishment, that to love God with all thy heart and thy neighbor as thyself is the sum of religion. There are the great points on which he endeavored to reform the religion of the Jews, but compare with these the demoralizing dogmas of Calvin." He was talking about Calvinism. So I'm going to skip that part, and I'm just going to drop down. "But much I fear that when this great truth shall be reestablished, Voltaire's will fall in the fatal error of fabricating formulas of creed and confessions of faith, the engines which so soon destroyed the religion of Jesus and made of Christendom a mere akeldama, that they will give up morals for mysteries and Jesus for Plato. How much wiser are the Quakers, who agreeing in the fundamental doctrines of the gospel, seismatize about no mysteries, and keeping within the pale of common sense, suffer no speculative differences of opinion any more than a feature to impair the love of their brethren. Be this the wisdom of the Unitarians. This is the holy mantle which shall cover with, in its charitable circumstances, all who believe in one God and who love their neighbors. And I conclude my sermon with sincere assurances and my friendly esteem and respect." So even back in 1822, there was concern about the overabuse of tobacco, which is a drug, and wine. Now, we've talked many times about tobacco on my show because I am a nurse that works with cancer patients, and I feel very, very strongly about smoking. I've always stressed it to my children, and I think people just really need to be informed about the cancer-causing ingredients that are in tobacco. There are hundreds of carcinogens that are added to cigarettes today, and it does cause cancer. 85 to 90% of all lung cancers are caused by tobacco use, whether it be chewing tobacco, where you can get mouth, tongue, throat cancer, or smoking, which causes number one cause of lung cancer. 85 to 90% of all lung cancers. You know, that's 160,000 cases of lung cancer a year, and that's about 160,000 deaths a year, because unfortunately lung cancer is usually present at an advanced stage, and we can't cure them, we can't fix them, but it is preventable. Don't smoke. Teach your children. It will cause cancer. Now, not everybody who smokes is going to get cancer. There's some people who have, I don't know, special genes, good genes, I don't know what you call it, but percentage-wise, if you're a smoker, you're 9 times more likely to get cancer. And it's not just lung cancer. It's stomach cancer. It's bladder cancer. They've attributed it to most cancers because the carcinogens go throughout the bloodstream. But also, not only does it cause cancer, it causes lung disease. Chronic obstructive lung disease. You see somebody walking around with an oxygen tank attached to them because their lungs aren't functioning because of the scarring from the cigarette smoking. Heart disease. You put them all together, and smoking cigarettes is responsible for 50% of all premature deaths. Now, by premature deaths, we mean deaths that occur before whatever the age 76, whatever the longevity of life is now considered to be. So, you know, that's, we've been on into that about cigarettes before. Alcohol-related injuries. You know, there's like 50,000. Let me read this. There were, in 2008, there were nearly 14,000 fatal alcohol-related crashes. 37% of all traffic fatalities in the United States were caused by drinking and driving. But that's not the least of it. Alcohol also causes death from cirrhosis of the liver, liver disease. You add alcohol with Tylenol, acetaminophen. Tylenol, folks, listen up, because Tylenol with alcohol can cause liver failure. It can kill you that way. So, you know, you've got nearly 50,000 deaths a year that occur because of alcohol-related problems. Not to mention that you have problems at home, often money problems for people who have addictions because they can't stop themselves from that drink. And once they have one drink, they have to have more drinks, and it causes problems with crime because people will commit crime to get money. They will steal money because alcohol is a drug. It's a depressant. There's also cases where it's depression, and, of course, alcohol is a depressant. Suicides also related to drinking. And then last week we were talking about marijuana. And like I said, from my standpoint as a mother and as a grandmother, no, I don't want to legalize any more drugs. We have enough problems. And they said, but it's going to alleviate problems like it has done in the Netherlands. Well, I was doing some research on that. And in the Netherlands, they have these cafes, but they've had this interesting problem where they're having increased crime around the cafes. Not from the people living in the Netherlands, but from people who go there to because drugs are legal. And so, you know, you're still going to have the problems with crime and related to the drugs. And they actually did a study in the American Journal of Psychiatry. It's a post-discharge cannabis use and its relationship to cocaine, alcohol, and heroin use. And it's a prospective study where they did some research, and they found that about after treatment, that about 50% there were 250 patients who were dependent on alcohol, cocaine, and or heroin at baseline. So when they first started the study, they were dependent. They had an addiction problem. Of those 250, 205 returned to the use of alcohol, cocaine, or heroin during the follow-up. So, only 45 people didn't go back to their addiction. Once you start down the path of the use of these drugs, it's very difficult to pull yourself back. So, what better way to avoid it than to just not start it at all? Of these 205 patients, 70 or 34% used cannabis after hospital discharge. Among the 45 patients who did not return to alcohol, cocaine, or heroin use during the follow-up, 3 used cannabis after hospital discharge. Thus, the percent of cannabis users after discharge was 5 times higher among patients who returned to using alcohol, cocaine, or heroin than among those that did not. Among those who were alcohol dependent at baseline, cannabis use was 3.8, almost 4 times higher among patients who returned to alcohol use during the follow-up than among those who did not. Among patients who were cocaine dependent at baseline, cannabis use was 2 times higher among patients who returned to cocaine use during the follow-up than among those who did not. Although cannabis use was more frequent among heroin-dependent patients who returned to heroin use than among those who did not, the difference was not significant. So this tends to suggest, and it may just suggest that there's a dependent personality, but more people use the marijuana and return to their addictions with not only alcohol, but cocaine and heroin. And also, we want to talk about the addiction rate, because some people will tell you that tobacco is not addicting. However, there is a 9% percentage of people who will become addicted to marijuana. It's defined as a habit that's compulsive and where users do not stop despite obvious detriment to their work and social lives. Marijuana certainly falls in this category. Estimates of just how addictive it is come from Psychology Today. An article by Juan Gumbiner, PhD, gives estimates of relative addiction potential and the percentage of those who use a drug and who become dependent upon it. Now, this is interesting because it's not just about marijuana. Heroin, there's a 23% addiction rate, which is pretty high. So, 23% of all people who do use heroin become addicts. Pretty high number. Tobacco, even higher, 32%. Now, there is a reason for this. They do add a chemical that is addicting to tobacco. So this is why this is such a high rate. You know, it's just not like you're growing a leaf and rolling it and smoking it. You know, there's chemicals and there's additives in the cigarettes that we smoke today. 32%. It's very addicting. So how best to not get to teach your children about the dangers of lung cancer and the dangers of throat cancer and have them not smoke? Because 32% of people who start smoking are going to be addicted to it. Cocaine has a 17% addiction rate, alcohol a 15% addiction rate, and marijuana 9%. These figures are backed up by the NIDA. Okay. And I also, some other articles I was reading was about, actually was in our paper today. I misplaced my paper now, but it was talking about the addiction of infants being born addicted and having to be put on a methadone. Methadone is a drug that they use for people who are addicted to help them with withdrawal symptoms. And there has been an increase in babies being born addicted to drugs. And that's a very sad statistic. And I just don't believe by making it easier to get these drugs that we're going to help anybody. And I know that in some places like New York, apparently you can go out on the street corner and buy them. Well, where I am in Indiana, it's not like that. And I think we need to continue to fight this in our country. I don't think we give in by making it legal. And people will talk about the health benefits. And yes, although there have not been any actual studies done, it appears that there may be some health benefits to it as far as treating chronic pain, nausea associated with chemotherapy, but there's no studies, okay? So we have no studies to even tell us this is true, okay? If we had studies, you know, then you could say, well, look here, it says this. But there aren't even any studies to tell us, you know, whether it contributes to lung cancer. Any irritant that you inhale into your lungs can cause scarring, can cause chronic obstructive lung disease, can cause lung cancer. So, you know, there is that risk, but if you don't have the actual studies, it's very difficult to, you know, put a percentage or put a value on it. There are drug addiction, drug abuse in the United States. In 2010, there was an estimated 22.6 Americans over the age of 12 that were current or former illicit drug users within the last month of when the survey was given. This equates to about 8.9% of the population age 12 or older. The drug marijuana was the most commonly used illegal substance. There was about 17.4 million individuals who used it in the past month from when the survey was taken. From 2007 to 2010, those numbers increased to 6.9%, up from 5.8 or 14.4 million to 17.4 million users. Now, we're still talking about just 7% of the population that are using these illegal drugs. But if you legalize it, I can guarantee that number is going to go up of the people who use it and risk the potential of addiction. Individuals 50 to 59 years of age, their rate of past drug use went up from 2.7 to 5.8 from 2002 to 2010. Again, you're kind of looking at the baby boomers, and you're looking at people born in the 60s and the 60s revolution, where the use of drugs and free love and everything was the, you know, the message of the day. So I think that kind of can contribute to that number among that age group. I am myself 50 and one of the last baby boomers coming through. An estimated 10 million individuals 12 to 20 years of age that admitted to being drinkers. Wow. 10 million people 12 to 20 drinking. 6.5 million were binge drinkers. Binge drinking kills people. And 2 million heavy drinkers. That's sad. Very, very sad. And again, I think it relates to, it's interesting because in Canada, we were there one year, we go there every year to fish, and these parents were giving their 3-year-old beer. And to me, that was just ridiculous because why, you know, would you give your 3-year-old beer? But that's what they do. They drink a lot of beer and wine in Canada. It's kind of their thing. But, you know, that this figure is kind of disturbing that there's this many binge and heavy drinkers under the age of 20. And what this tells, you know, because alcohol is a depressant. It's not a stimulant. Yeah, people might feel good when they take it, but it's actually a depressant. It depresses brain cells. And then, again, leads to the fatalities that we talked of, about, you know, 14, 15,000 a year. Over 6 million children in America live with at least one parent who has a drug addiction. Now, this is a sad statistic because in these situations, there can be neglect and there can be child abuse and other problems that go on in this home can contribute to living in poverty because they have to feed their addiction rather than care for their children. So that's 6 million children at risk there. Since 1980, the number of deaths related to drug overdoses had risen over 540%. And the most commonly abused drug other than alcohol in the United States by individuals over the age of 12 is marijuana, followed by prescription painkillers, cocaine, and hallucinogens. Each year, drug abuse and drug addiction cost employers over $122 billion in lost productivity time and another $15 billion in health insurance cost. Baltimore, Maryland has more per capita individuals living with heroin addiction than any other state in the United States. Now, I'm not sure why that is. I might have to look into that just to see what's going on in Maryland. What are you doing over there in Maryland to have that figure at that percentage? But and since 1990, number of individuals who take prescription drugs illegally is believed to have risen over 500%. Another alarming statistic because all these drugs do kill. And we have lost, I mean, it should be a wake-up call. You know, we've lost, people die every day from this, I'm sure, and many people have lost children. But, you know, you see the high-profile deaths like Whitney Houston, who actually with cocaine was involved in her death along with other drugs. Heath Ledger, who died from prescription drug overdose. Amy Winehart, I think, died from alcohol abuse and drug use. I mean, this is a problem. And we need to address the problem of this abuse of these drugs. And a lot of times there's some underlying psychological problems. People get drunk to leave their problems behind. And yet it's depressant. So, you know, you see an increase in the amount of suicides that are alcohol related because it is a depressant, even though it appears to be a stimulant by the way people's actions, but it is not. It is a depressant. So actually, those are kind of some of my feelings and some of my research on the topic of drugs and why I am not in favor of actually legalizing them. Some of the science says that there can be effects on your brain from smoking marijuana. I do know that there can be effects on your brains from drinking. They all affect your reaction time and that type of thing. So that's a topic from last week, and that's kind of my facts or my how I feel about that. So we have a little more time here, so we will go into a little more. Let's go into a little more of some of Thomas Jefferson's viewpoints, and let me just bring up here. I'm going to have to pull it up real quick because we did his first inaugural address, and there's some interesting things that I'd like to bring up from his second address, because they apply somewhat today also. Some of the things that he did during his time in office, I'd like to see happen in our government today. So now we're going to, he was reelected obviously for a second term, and in March of 1805, he gave his second inaugural address. And this is how this goes. Proceeding, fellow citizens, that qualification with the Constitution, again, we're referring to the Constitution, requires before my entrance on the charge again conferred on me, it is my duty to express the deep sense I entertain of this new proof of confidence from my fellow citizens at large, and the zeal with which it inspires me to conduct myself as may best satisfy their expectations. Once again, we see that he the willingness and inspiration on his part to want to be what the citizens, the people, want him to be. On taking the station on a former occasion, I declared the principles on which I believed it my duty to administer the affairs of our commonwealth. My conscience tells me I have on every occasion acted up to that declaration according to its obvious import and to the understanding of every candid mind. In transaction of your foreign affairs, we have endeavored to cultivate the friendship of all nations, and especially of those with which we have the most important relations. We have done them justice on all occasions, favored where favor was lawful, and cherished mutual interests and intercourse on fair and equal terms. We are firmly convinced, and we act on that conviction, that with nations as with individuals, our interests soundly calculated will ever be found inseparable from our moral duties. And history bears witness to the fact that a just nation is trusted on its word when recourse is had to armaments and war to bridle others. So here he's talking about how it's our moral duties and being trusted for your word, which is, I'm sorry, but it's very difficult to find in a politician these days, someone who you could take at their face value and at their word. At home, fellow citizens, you best know whether we have done well or ill. The suppression of unnecessary offices. Oh, how much could we use that today? Unnecessary offices. How many unnecessary offices do we have in Washington at this very moment in time? Of useless establishments and expenses. And how many of those do we have at this day and time? Enabled us to discontinue our internal taxes. They were able to stop internal taxes on the people by getting rid of the useless establishments and the unnecessary offices. And this is what we want them to do in Washington today. These covering our land with officers and opening our doors to their intrusions had already begun that process of domiciliary vexation, which once entered is scarcely to be restrained from reaching successively every article of property and produce. Oh, my. And that has happened, unfortunately, today, because the government is out of control. At his point in time, Thomas Jefferson was able to roll those back, and we hope that once again we can get a president and a Congress in that will once again roll back those unnecessary offices of establishments. If among these taxes some minor ones fell which had not been inconvenient, it was because their amount would not have paid the officers who collected them. Okay, common sense here. Okay, we did away with taxes because, you know, it wouldn't have paid for the officers who we had to send out to collect them, because anytime you put a new tax, you've got to put somebody in place to collect those taxes. And because if they had any merit, the state authorities might adopt them instead of others less approved. So here, and we go back to the state authorities. Once again, Thomas Jefferson emphasizing the state authorities rather than that of government. The remaining revenue on the consumption of foreign articles is paid chiefly by those who can afford to add foreign luxuries to domestic comfort. So here, this is, you know, those paying the taxes are those who can afford to buy these imported goods that they were taxing. Being collected on our seaboard and frontiers only and incorporated with the transactions of our mercantile citizens. It may be the pleasure and the pride of an American ask, what farmer, what mechanic, what laborer even sees a tax gatherer of the United States? And now we have the IRS. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't pay any taxes, because obviously you have to have money to function. But I want my government to function in a responsible and frugal manner. And I want the corruption and the waste out of Washington. And I feel a lot of you, if you're listening tonight, you probably have those same convictions. These contributions enable us to support the current expenses of the government, to fulfill contracts with foreign nations, to extinguish the native right of soil within our limits, to extend those limits, and to place such a surplus to our public debts as places at a short day their final redemption. And that redemption once affected the revenue thereby liberated may by a just repartition of it among the states. So we're going to pay off our debt, and if we get this revenue, it's going to go back to the states. And a corresponding amendment of the Constitution be implied in times of peace to rivers, canals, roads, arts, manufacturers, education, and other great objects within each state. In time of war, if injustice by ourselves or others must sometimes produce war, increased at the same revenue will be by increased population and consumption, and aided by other resources reserved for that crisis. It may meet within the year all the expenses of the year without encroaching on the rights of future generations. Without encroaching on the rights of future generations, what have we done to our children by burdening them with the debts of the past? $15 trillion. War will then be but a suspension of useful works and a return to a state of peace, a return to the progress of improvements. I have said, fellow citizens, that the income reserved had enabled us to extend our limits, but that extension may possibly pay for itself before we are called on, and in the meantime may keep down the accruing interest. In all events, it will replace the advances we shall have made. I know that the acquisition of Louisiana had been disapproved by some from a candid apprehension that the enlargement of our territory would endanger the Union. But who can limit the extent to which the federative principle may operate effectively? The larger our association, the less will it be shaken by local passions. And in any view, is it not better that the opposite bank of the Mississippi should be settled by our own brethren and children than by strangers of another family, with which should we be most likely to live in harmony and friendly intercourse? In matters of religion, I have considered that its free exercise is placed by the Constitution independent of the powers of the general government. I have therefore undertaken on no occasion to prescribe the religious exercise suited to it, but have left them, as the Constitution found them, under the direction and discipline of the church or the state authorities acknowledged by several religious societies. In other words, he's let the religions practice freely as long as they were not infringing, but not causing harm to another individual in the country. the Aboriginal inhabitants of these countries, talking about the Indians, I have regarded with the commiseration their history inspires, endowed with the faculties and the rights of men, breathing an ardent love of liberty and independence, and occupying a country which left them no desire but to be undisturbed. The stream of overflowing population from other regions directed itself on these shores. Without power to divert or have a stick to contend against it, they have been overwhelmed by the current or driven before it. Now reduced within limits too narrow for the hunter state, humanity enjoins us to teach them agriculture and the domestic arts, and to encourage them to the industry which alone can enable them to maintain their place in existence, and to prepare them in time for the state of society which to bodily comfort adds the improvements of the mind and morals. We have therefore liberally furnished them with the implements of husbandry and household use, and we have placed among them instructors in the arts of first necessity, and they are covered with the aegis of the law against aggressors from amongst ourselves. So here he's talking about the Indians and what they've done to try to help them and protect them. And next paragraph goes on to how he tried to enlighten them and talks about prejudice of their mind, ignorance, pride, and the crafty individuals among them. Now, you know, that so much doesn't so much apply what it is today, as we're not, it very well could. If actually, I'm going to go ahead and read this, because we're dealing with a different kind of infiltration today. But the endeavors to enlighten them on the fate which awaits their present course of life, to induce them to exercise their reason, follow its dictates, and change their pursuits with the change of circumstance, have powerful obstacles to encounter. They are combated by the habits of their bodies, prejudices of their minds, ignorance, pride, and the influence of interested and crafty individuals among them who feel themselves something in the present order of things and fear to become nothing in any other. So people, you know, wanting to retain onto their own prejudices that they had. And he's talking about the Indians. These persons inculcate a sanctimonious reverence for the customs of their ancestors, that whatsoever they did must be done through all time, that reason is a false guide, and to advance under its counsel in their physical, moral, political condition is perilous innovation, that their duty is to remain as their Creator made them, ignorance being safety and knowledge full of danger. In short, my friends, among them also is seen the action and counteraction of good sense and of bigotry. They too have their anti-philosophists who find an interest in keeping things in their present state, who dread reformation and exert all their faculties to maintain the ascendancy of habit over the duty of improving our reason and obeying its mandate. In giving these outlines, I do not mean, fellow citizens, to arrogate to myself the merit of the measure that is due in the first place to reflecting character of our citizens at large, who by the weight of public opinion influence and strengthen the public measure. It is due to the sound discretion with which they select from among themselves those to whom they confide the legislative duties. It is due to the zeal and wisdom of these characters thus selected, who lay the foundations of public happiness and wholesome laws. The execution which alone remains for others, and it is due to the able and faithful auxiliaries whose patriotism has associated them with me in the executive functions. So here, you know, he's talking a little bit about the Indians and them hanging on to their preconceived ideas and not conforming to what the Union of America and the moral values. And I think that can somewhat apply maybe to various religions that are coming into our country today with bringing their laws, which do not conform at all to our constitutional laws. Now, again, hindsight being better than foresight, the Indians were obviously very mistreated in this country, as this was their country first. And I don't agree with their treatment, and not necessarily under Thomas Jefferson's time, but, you know, as the years go on, we all know about the Trail of Tears and the different things went on, the injustices done to them as a people, which is just, you know, it happened. And again, you know, we are not really responsible for what our fathers did before us, but it was kind of cruel and really unjust. And the government did what what Jefferson didn't agree with, and he lied to these people. You know, they made treaties with them, and then they broke them, which doesn't look good upon us. So that was in his second inaugural speech, and I just loved the part where he had gotten rid of the useless and unnecessary parts of government. And I just so wish, and I so pray, and I think we're working on that. Here in Indiana, we're working on a Senate race against Senator Lugar. A lot of people know who he is because he's been in Washington for 36 years. 36 years, and he wants another six. He's 80 years old. So he's spent a good portion of his life, nearly half his life, in Washington. And hopefully, it's looking good. Hopefully, here in Indiana, next Tuesday, we're going to vote for change. Now, and I should bring this up. This is the first time that he's ever been opposed by a Republican candidate. And he is Richard Murdoch, who is for limited government, for doing away with certain departments in the government, for balancing the budget, for everything that you could possibly want in a limited government. So we will see on Tuesday how we, the people, actually come out against the establishment. I was at a Tea Party rally where Richard Murdoch was there. I'm not a Tea Party person. I'm more right-wing conservative, but we agree on so many things when it comes to limited government. And at that point, the super PAC that was supporting Richard Lugar here in Indiana was pulling out. And Murdoch had risen to a 4 percentage point lead over Lugar. So I'm hoping that is all good news. We're working here on the ground. I need you to do this in your state. I need you to get out, and I need you to support. We all need to be supporting that conservative candidate. And we might not get the presidential candidate we want, but the legislative branch can rein in the president constitutionally. But we've got to get the people in there who are willing to stand up and say in public. And this is the problem I had with Senator Lugar. He's been there 36 years. You think he would come out and actually condemn some of these actions that the president is doing, but you don't see it. You don't see it happening. You don't see the leadership there that after 36 years you would think he would have the potential to do. And so that bothers me. But, you know, it's time. And like Richard Murdoch says, we applaud him for his service for all this time. But it's time. It's time for a new candidate. So that's what we're working on here in Indiana. And I hope that in other states across the country, you're also working on getting those conservatives elected to office. They try to make us out. They try to make the Tea Party out to be a bad organization, when in reality, the Tea Party is what I would consider the constitutional party, the party that wants to get us back on track. As Jefferson said, you know, in his first inaugural speech, that, you know, you start getting off the track, it's very, very hard to get back on track. And there's a lot of people that will fight it because they get money from the government, or they have a program, or there's something good. But it's got to happen. And how much more will we be hurting if we continue with this present course that we're taking? And I have a caller at 7112, so bring him online. Hi, who do I have at 7112?
Okay, Brenda, what happened tonight?
Hi, Billy. I don't know. I thought it was set up for 9.
Goodness. I went in at 6:45, and I'm like, wait a minute. It says 3 hours until 3 hours and 8 minutes or 18 minutes or whatever. And I was like, wait a minute. Something's wrong here.
I know, and then I'm running around frantically looking for a phone. Okay, we have 4 phones in this house because I got your number, okay? And I'm frantically running around because I got in probably just after you did and changed it back.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going, what in the heck is this, 11? And no, I'm not doing my show at 11. And I couldn't find a phone. And it's like, oh, great. So I couldn't call you because I couldn't find even my cell phone. It's like, wonderful.
Oh my goodness.
I just had to wing it myself tonight. Fortunately, I had a lot of Thomas Jefferson words, you know, from his inaugural addresses. So, you know, I had some help from Thomas Jefferson to make some points, some really interesting things. So, but yeah, hi, Billy.
Hi.
How are you? Yeah,
I'm logging in now to the studio. I was like, I came in, I was just about to log in, you know, to call you to open the show at 10, you know, because that's what it said.
Uh-huh.
And there, it's on air. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm calling right now.
Well, I'm glad you did. We got about 15 minutes left now. So,
oh,
what do you have to say tonight? Yeah, what's on your mind tonight? Go ahead.
I guess I'll vent a lot more on Obamanation Friday, but there's just a lot of stuff going on with, well, the death of Bin Laden, how they're publicizing it.
Yeah, it's great.
One of the things I wanna touch base on more than anything is the idea of competition in our country.
Yes.
Competition. You know, it even comes down to, you know, even smokers. You know, there's some businesses that don't allow smokers inside,
right.
And there are some that, and actually there's a federal law saying you can't. But I think that smokers should have a right to go into a business all their own and create a business that says for smokers only. I think that's part of competition, that if people who don't smoke want to go to that business, then that's at their own peril. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I almost tend to agree, except for, you know, then will all the businesses do that? And, you know, I personally like to do karaoke.
Well, yeah,
but,
I know.
You know, when I go
but
into a
but there should be
bar
maybe one
smoke. You know, I know that I'm, like, probably killing myself while I'm singing, you know.
But, you know, they've got, like, 20 bars on the strip. They should designate one that allows smokers in.
Yeah.
They shouldn't discriminate against smokers. And it's not just, you know, I got around this over the fact that they're starting to ban the happy hour at some bars now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, see, that's over.
And that's
they're
overreaching. Where,
they're really.
Yeah.
And I was talking about, I read Jefferson's inaugural speech about how limited the government was supposed to be and how the power was to the states, you know, and not to the federal government. And it's just, it's out of control. It's just insanely out of control.
But
and,
see, you know, the worst part about that is there's now a federal law prohibiting the startup of a business like that. The startup of a business that it could even just be like for women only, or you can't do that kind of stuff. It's considered discrimination. And that's kind of like anti, you know, to me, it's like the opposite.
Anti-America.
It's very anti-America.
Anti-freedom.
American.
Anti-freedom.
It's like there was this restaurant down south. I don't remember where. I think it was in Louisiana or Arkansas or something. And he used the profanity that he does not support the blank in office, and he used the N-word on his sign. And I was reading about this, and you know what I said to myself? I'm like, you know what I would do if I saw that? I'd go across the street and show him that I don't like that sign, therefore I'm going to eat somewhere other than his place.
Yeah.
And then maybe he'll take it down of his own free will, but I'm not going to go in there and tell him, you got to take that down.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
That's actually part of his freedom of speech.
It is his freedom.
You know, if
he
you
has
want
the
be,
right to say whatever
right.
he wants. But the ACLU does not have the right to come in there and say, oh, you bad boy, you can't say those words.
Yeah.
Actually, he can. They're his
censorship.
Right.
It's called censorship.
But, you know, some of us choose not to say them. I'll tell you straight up,
well,
I say the N-word or, I don't say the word. Ever since I was, before I could even say the word, my parents were saying, don't say that word ever.
Right.
And I disciplined myself not to do it.
But I mean, here's by the same token, you know, the F word offends me. I don't say it. I don't like to hear
exactly.
it. Exactly. But you know what I do? I just don't watch shows that have that in it. Or if there's people that use it a lot, I don't tend to gravitate to them because
yeah.
you know, I don't like it.
But you don't sit here and say, hey, don't say that word around me.
No.
You might be offended. And
you could ask, say, I'm offended. Using that, you know, you could ask politely, but there shouldn't be a federal law saying you can't talk that way, because that's such an infringement on our rights and on what the what our freedoms are. But we are, you know, it's just we are so far off track, and it looks like Murdoch may be winning here in Indiana on Tuesday. So that's what we're working hard on here in Indiana. He's actually went from being 1% ahead of Lugar to being 5% ahead of Lugar in the poll.
Oh, yeah?
And the super PAC that was putting money into Lugar's run pulled out.
Wow.
So, which is an indication that he's not polling as well as they thought he should.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be some good news coming out of a Tuesday's election here. So I'm hoping. Because we've got to start somewhere. And, you know, got to start somewhere. And I guess, you know, the best place to start is, you know, try to get some this conservative people in Congress who are more for the state rights and for the freedom granted by the Constitution. So,
yeah.
But yeah, they're just totally out of control in the regulations and the government intrusion into our lives is just phenomenal. And this is the problem. You get one little law. It's that door in the foot in the door philosophy Reagan talked about.
Yeah.
You know, you get that first law. Well, that doesn't seem too bad. Well, here comes the next one, or here comes the next.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it just spirals, and that's we're seeing.
Well, see, the thing is, they get the first law. It's like what's going on right now with the ACLU and crosses. They're trying to get the Supreme Court or one of the federal courts to say this is unconstitutional. You have to not have a cross in a public area, so that
right.
they can get the first precedent, and then they can use that precedent to make it happen everywhere.
Right, exactly. And in fact, I was told at this Tea Party event I was at that it is legal to have under God in our pledge, and it is like the Ninth Court of Appeals upheld that we can have in God we trust on our money. So, you know, that's some good news coming out of the court systems. And I referred to that earlier. The Supreme Court is actually saving us from the madness, you know, because, you know, right now they've got the healthcare law and they're getting the Arizona immigration law. And so, you know, this may be our last, you know, stand. It's that Supreme
mm-hmm.
keeping us from, you know, just totally going over the cliff, you know, in a barrel, you know,
yeah.
Niagara Falls.
See, the thing is, this is the thing with the left. They've got Roe v. Wade. That's like the only thing they've got.
Yeah.
And that was their foot in the door for some of these other things that they're
Absolutely.
Trying to claim.
Absolutely.
And they can only, really, they can't fight some things. But using Roe v. Wade, it gets them supporters of things that they want to happen.
Oh, yeah.
So that they can get the right president elected, so they can get the right people on the court, so they can get the court to legislate instead of, you know, be judicial.
Right.
And
right.
just abide the law.
Right, absolutely. And I was talking earlier how I lost my train of thought for a minute, but about the Constitution and how if we go back and actually look at I downloaded like 2,000 pages of Thomas Jefferson's writing and I was reading his autobiography, and it's just mm-hmm. amazing the insight it can give you into his mind. You know, he's someone that wrote the Declaration of Independence, and in the initial draft that he wrote, he had a section in there that said slavery was a horrendous crime against humanity, but they
mm-hmm.
didn't pass it because, you know, South Carolina and Georgia wouldn't pass it with that, and they wanted to have as much unity as they could because obviously they were going up against Great Britain, one of the powerhouses of the time. So, you know, but it was interesting to be reading that and saying, you know, Herman Cain was right when he said that all men are created equal. Because Thomas Jefferson did mean it that way, to include all men, including the black man. You know, that's how it was originally intended to be when Thomas Jefferson wrote it. And so I think, you know, these people on the Supreme Court, they need to be looking at the history and they need to be reading the writings of these men who wrote the
yeah.
Constitution. But they're not. They're not. And they don't want to because, you know, like you said, the ones who want to interpret, you know, they've got a whole different agenda than what was intended by our founding fathers, you know, for this country. So it really is kind of a precarious place that we're in because we know that there are Supreme Court nominations probably going to come up in the next 4 years. And if at all possible, you know, if we don't get a conservative president, we at least want Congress to be able to put a stop to it, you know, because we certainly don't need any more Kagans.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, even Sotomayor, though, Sotomayor has, at least when it came down to, like, trying to make the clergy into saying that, you know, Catholics have to let women become priests,
uh-huh.
At least they voted 9-0 on stuff like that.
Right. And so that's
and to me, that shows a good thing for the freedom of religion versus the freedom from religion.
Right. Right. And it's not, and I actually went into that a little bit because in his inaugural address, Thomas Jefferson addressed the religious intolerance because of the Church of England that was in, the king was the head of in England, and
mm-hmm.
you had to do it their way or not, and how, you know, he had seen the evils of the Catholic Church in France because they were abusing their powers, you know, and that's where he comes from
right.
his perspective that, you know, you got to tolerate all these religions, you know, it's, you know, there, we all believe the one God, and you need to focus on the things that you agree on, since it's, you know, the murder and the stealing and the different things that all religions can agree on. And so, you know, it wasn't not having religion in the government. It was protecting all those religions to allow them their freedom.
Well, in my opinion, the way I always read it was that it was not allowing the government to rule the church, letting the church to rule itself. Because,
yeah.
like,
not
in
just,
England,
not
like you
speakers,
said, it was the government.
Right.
It was the king ruling the church. And that's where they came here and said, no, we don't want to rule the church. We want the church to you know, keep its own space, do its own thing, and we'll rule the people.
Yeah, and they didn't want one central religion. Not because Thomas Jefferson was a promoter of, you know, tolerating all religions, you know, in their practice. So because that's how you keep, because that's how you keep, you know, you don't want.
You know, I have a big thing about, there are so many people out here who don't know what deists are and the religion of deity.
Mm-hmm.
And they honestly think that deists are atheists when
that
is
not.
So wrong.
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson was not an atheist. He believed in God.
No.
He just
But he was a deist. He was a Freemason.
Yeah, he didn't practice with any particular, like, Baptist or, you know, Catholic. Or he had a big animosity for the Catholic Church and the Church of England just because of what had gone on in France and England, what he had seen.
Right.
But he definitely believed in God, and you see it in his writings, and you see it in the Declaration of Independence, our Creator, and you see it in his inaugural address, and you see that he believed in God, and he believed that we should all live, that Jesus was the most moral man to ever walk the earth. Now, he didn't believe in the Trinity. You know, like many of us
do,
no. God in three persons. But, you know,
right.
I read earlier that where he was talking about that the interests of society require the observation of those moral precepts only in which
mm-hmm.
all religions agree. You see, so
right.
he was like, you know, because, you know, we're all told not to murder. Basically, the Ten Commandments. You know, all
exactly.
religions pretty much agree on the Ten Commandments. And that
and
was
those are considered natural law. Those are laws handed down by God,
yes.
including marriage.
Exactly.
Marriage was a law handed down by God,
yes.
where he and all the forefathers believed those laws cannot be touched. Those are the pursuit of happiness. Those are
right.
the life, the liberty
Absolutely.
That we want to live.
And it's what our founding fathers actually meant when they talk. Well, we're going to run out of time, Billy, and I'm so sorry, but I did. I really was running around looking for a phone, and my husband
You better
left,
call me on Friday.
Okay, I'll try. I know I missed last Friday, but I will definitely try.
Oh, my phone died completely on Friday. I had to get a new one.
Now, you come
yeah.
on at 7 Eastern. What time Eastern?
I come on at 8 Central, which is 9 Eastern, I think.
9 Eastern? Okay, yeah,
uh-huh.
okay. All right.
Are you up that late?
Usually. Not on Thursday.
Okay.
Thursdays because I have to work Fridays. I go to bed earlier. But, yeah, I'll try to call in this Friday because I know I missed
okay.
last Friday. But, yeah, and I did. I was like, I'm running around, where are the phones when I need one? 4 minutes to showtime.
Oh, I know that feeling. I've been there.
And so I kind of knew I was probably going to have to wing it, but it's like, ah, I need my belly on here.
I know. I have to admit, we were watching the movie Click the other day, and there's this one part that I always fast forward through that I don't want the children to see. It's just a little bit too, but it's a fun movie to watch with the kids.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, okay, wait a minute, it's coming up. Where's the remote? You know, so I'm like, okay, I just stopped the whole thing until I found the remote.
All right, well, thank you, everybody, for calling in. Be sure to turn into Nobomination. You're doing both Thursday and Friday?
Yeah, no, just Friday. I'm not going to be doing Thursdays anymore.
Okay, Friday at 10. All right, take care.
Well, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye, Billy. Talk to you soon.